From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, we're marking the fifth anniversary of our poverty tour. In 2011, I traveled with my friend and colleague, Dr. Cornel West, to 18 cities across the country and met hundreds of folk who were struggling with poverty in the aftermath of the Great Recession. On today's show, I'll talk to leaders in the anti-poverty movement. I'll speak to Mia Birdsong, co-director of Family Story, and Mayor of Los Angeles, Eric Garcetti, who talks about next steps in the fight against poverty. But first, we'll start with highlights from our Sojourn for Truth to reintroduce you, or perhaps introduce you for the first time.
There's a new poor in America right now. I'm going to take the old poor and the new poor and put them together.
Corporations get away again. Wall Street got away again. The banks got away again. This entire piece of legislation is on the backs of the poor.
And the more I see what people are going through, all people of all races, of all colors, of all creeds, the more I see that, the more angry it makes me. And that's why I left the studio. That's why I gave up my vacation time. That's why I called my friends, called Dr. West, and we hit the road to get this stuff captured. When we say all the time, it's the telling of truth. It's the telling of truth that allows something to speak.
Of 1 in 3 service members who are deployed will suffer the effects of post-traumatic stress.
When I left my home, I was 27 years old. Everybody spoke with you about even the little kids now. There's only about 100, maybe more than, maybe 400 in all the reservation.
Remember, this area right here is the second, according to Chicago Reporter, the second most unemployed community neighborhood in the country. The only one that beats it is in Detroit.
The conditions in which our government will respond to the crisis. The Chicago anti-eviction campaign was born because folks from different parts of the city, the black community, white community, and the Latino community, had saw that their housing was leaving. Our struggle here relates to education cuts, divestment in labor, and housing, right? So all of these struggles are intertwined.
Highlights from the original poverty tour, which we captured 5 years ago. We're going to find out if things have gotten better, worse, or stayed the same. Sheldon Danziger has spent his career tracking the war on poverty. He's professor emeritus at the University of Michigan and president of the Russell Sage Foundation, which is devoted exclusively to research in the social sciences. In 2013, he edited the text, Legacies of the War on Poverty, and last year, he led a working group organized by Brookings and American Enterprise Institute, which produced an extensive 88-page report titled Opportunity, Responsibility, and Security, a Consensus Plan for Reducing Poverty and Restoring the American Dream. He joins us now from New York City. Sheldon, good to have you on the program.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Are we better off? Are we about the same? Or getting worse where the issue of poverty and income inequality and economic mobility are concerned?
Well, there's some good news. The unemployment rate is down, and there are many millions of more people working today than was the case 5 years ago. And probably most importantly, about 20 million additional Americans have health insurance because of the Affordable Care Act. However, we've not made much progress against poverty, in part because while the number of jobs has increased, Congress has not raised the minimum wage. So we have lots of people who are working and back at work, but they're still earning wages that are too low and don't allow them to support their families above the poverty line.
What do you make of the fact, Sheldon, that there have been some increases across the country, as you well know, in the minimum wage, but it's happening state by state, more expressly and more accurately, it's happening city by city, has not become a mandate of the federal government. How do you read that reality?
Well, I think the states and cities that are doing this are leading the way because Congress, since the president took office in 2009, has refused to do just about anything he requested. I find it interesting that on both political parties are now recognizing that wages have stagnated for millions of workers. Most people have pointed out that median family income today is lower than it was in 2000, the year George W. Bush took office. Yet, even when there are policies that both sides agree on that would do more to reduce poverty, Congress has not been able to take any federal action. I'll give you one example. The stimulus bill included something which allowed state governments to subsidize either private employers or public employers to hire the long-term unemployed, welfare recipients, and others. It was called the Emergency Jobs Fund. Governors in many states hired, used that program to get employers to hire the long-term unemployed, Republican governors and Democratic governors. But when it came time to extend that program, Republicans in Congress refused. So there are lots of policies which could help the poor and those who've been left behind in the economic growth we've had over the last 5 years, but leadership isn't coming out of Washington.
I'll come back to those policies a little bit later in our conversation, though, but just you're talking now about these government programs, and again, we heard echoes of some of this at the recent Republican convention in Cleveland. There are many Americans who blame precisely government programs for the increase or lack of real reduction in poverty in this country. And that argument, as you know, goes way back to the war on poverty and all the critiques that we continue to read coming out of that, that once again, it is these government programs that are in fact responsible for poverty not being reduced in significant ways. How do you respond to those kinds of concerns, those kinds of thoughts?
Well, we have about 50 years of research that says those claims are overblown. You can always find anecdotal evidence of somebody who stays on unemployment insurance and turns down a job. But those claims forget that every market has a supply side and a demand side. So when people talk about disincentives to look for work, they act as if anybody who looks for work will find a job. But there's a demand side of the labor market, and the demand side of the labor market is controlled by employers. So if you've been unemployed for a long period, or you've been incarcerated, or you're a high school dropout, you can look for work all you want, but many employers are not going to hire you. So incentive to look for work or no incentive to look for work, we've got to focus on the demand side of the labor market.
And what about the notion that it is the poor themselves who are to blame, whether it be bad choices, whether it be laziness, whether it be any number of other issues? For those who think that the poor, in fact, are to blame for their plight, you say what to that?
Well, I say, again, if one looks at the research evidence, one finds stories, and I suspect you came across that in your tour where you went to many places and talked to many people. There are people who were once middle class who were laid off in the Great Recession through no fault of their own because their firm downsized or their firm went bankrupt. And they may have looked and looked, and unemployment insurance provided some benefits to them, but unemployment insurance is time limited and ran out long ago. And many of those workers have not been able to find employers who hire them. The same thing, we talk about lack of education or lack of skills. If we lived in a world where all our children had equal opportunities to gain the skills needed in today's economy, then we could say, okay, you have the skills, maybe you need to look harder for work. But we all know that our public schools are unequal, that some children get an excellent education, and some children, through no fault of their own, live in neighborhoods and school districts where they don't get a very good education. So I think that what the Brookings American Enterprise Institute group tried to do was to say there are two sides to every issue. There is personal responsibility. No one is going to deny that it takes personal responsibility to look for work. But there's also societal responsibility that those who want to work hard and play by the rules have an opportunity to achieve those. And so one of the things our group focused on, and this was a group that covers much of the political spectrum, was saying people should not, for example, be cut off food stamp benefits if they don't have a job, if they are willing to work. And so if you're willing to work and can't find an employer, then our program called for government to either subsidize private sector employers or nonprofit employers, but to make sure everybody had the opportunity to work. Then you have a level playing field.
You've answered some of this question now, Sheldon. I want to go a little bit deeper. And so the question that I want to ask now is in part philosophical, and it is clearly in part political. But the question is, what is the proper role of government in a conversation about lifting people out of poverty? Again, we've just come off recently two conventions, two different ideas, two different ways of seeing this particular issue. And whether one agrees with Republicans or Democrats, there has to be a way to get to a conversation that has some reasonable outcome, some reasonable answer to the question of what the proper role of government ought to be when it comes to the issue of poverty.
Well, it's unfortunate that we don't have a lot of bipartisan discourse. Let me give you an example of a policy that was proposed by President Obama and proposed in a slightly different form by Speaker Ryan. It's something called the Earned Income Tax Credit. Mm-hmm. And both sides seemed to agree that we needed to raise that. And the Earned Income Tax Credit supplements the low wages of workers, but it's very low for workers without children. So both sides agreed that with the minimum wage we now have, raising the Earned Income Tax Credit for workers without children would be beneficial, would give them more of an incentive to work, look for work, and if they had work, would make work pay more. The problem came about how to pay for it. One side wants to pay for it by increasing tax revenues. The other side wants to pay for it by cutting other government spending. And the sides don't sit down and say, okay, let's meet each other halfway. We'll cut spending half as much, we'll raise taxes for the other half, and we'll be able to go forward with this policy. So unfortunately, even when there are policies that people agree on, there's not much movement to go forward.
I find that story fascinating, Sheldon, in part because, as you well know, even Ronald Reagan once called the Earned Income Tax Credit the greatest anti-poverty program we had. And so if Reagan can even offer that assessment and they still can't find a way to meet in the middle on it, it is beyond disturbing, but I digress on that. I guess the question is, where jobs are concerned, whether or not it is your belief that Democrats specifically, the Obama administration specifically, worked hard enough to get to jobs with a living wage for every American. Donald Trump, whatever one thinks of him, has raised this issue time and time again. I mean, he went bold with it when he talked specifically about the high unemployment rate in Black America, talked specifically about the high unemployment rate for young African Americans, in particular Black men, but has made the point time and time again that what he will do is to bring jobs. Now, he hasn't said how he's going to do that, but he continues to say at least that the issue here is jobs with a living wage. Did the Democrats do enough over the last 8 years to make that a real issue?
Well, I think they certainly have. And in fact, if you go back to Bill Clinton's campaign in 1992, these were the very issues that were on the table. Let's talk about the best way to bring jobs back. One way, again, it used to be bipartisan. Let's talk about infrastructure. There are decaying bridges and highways in every congressional district in this country. It should not be political to say we're going to raise government revenue, put people to work, and fix bridges and roads. In fact, it will increase productivity because businesses will be able to get their products across the country and from one market to the other in quicker time. So it's a win-win situation. Unemployment rates have been very low. The president had jobs in the stimulus bill. When the stimulus bill expired, the president wanted to expand. Another area that would increase jobs, early childhood education. The president has proposed expanding early childhood education. Every county, every school district in the country could hire new preschool teachers if government were willing to pay funds. So there are ways to bring jobs back that government could do in ways that are, you know, I don't find child care for three-year-olds and early education for three-year-olds or infrastructure political.
Barack Obama has, on more than one occasion, echoed Ronald Reagan by suggesting that a rising tide will lift all boats. That sounds to me like trickle down, and I don't want to believe that President Obama intended that with his remarks, but it is a direct quote from Reagan that a rising tide will lift all boats. Do you agree with that?
Well, a rising tide lifted all boats from the end of World War II till about the early 1970s. And since then, a rising tide hasn't lifted all boats. When we talk about what's happened since 2009, and we mention that wages are stagnant and middle-class incomes are stagnant, the annual salaries of the CEOs of the largest firms are up 50% since 2009. CEOs average $15.5 million a year. So a rising tide is only these days lifting the boats at the very top, and we need a set of explicit policies to fix things for those people at the bottom. And, you know, saying you're going to slap tariffs on the Chinese is only a soundbite, because if we start slapping tariffs on people, they're going to be less likely to buy Boeing airplanes. They're going to be less likely to buy other U.S. products. So trade wars, I don't think, are a way to bring jobs back. And in fact, they neglect one of the issues of the times we live in, and nobody is to blame for this, but technological changes are pervasive throughout a lot of fields in the economy, and technology is labor saving. I don't think anybody has said, we should shut down the internet because when I go on the internet, I can buy goods and services anywhere in the country, and if I didn't have the internet, the local store, which used to be at the corner selling those goods and services, would come back and serve them. So the idea that we're going to make big changes through tariffs, the equivalent would be that we're going to shut down the internet because large companies that do business on the internet have displaced the mom and pop stores that used to line our main streets.
To your point about technology, what say you, and more expressly, what are we doing or not doing about job retraining for those persons across the country whose jobs have been lost to technological innovation?
Well, that's another area where I think there's a lot of agreement. Think about community college. There are good jobs like nurse, starting as a nurse's aide and working up through registered nurses, where we have shortages, where you can get trained at a community college. There are shortages of welders. You can get trained at community colleges. But we haven't done enough to provide the kinds of resources to community colleges for them to do the kind of training that workers need. In fact, state governments, in balancing their budgets during the Great Recession, greatly cut back on the amounts of money that they provide not only to four-year universities, but to community colleges. So one can go through a whole range of areas. We've already talked about quite a few here where a bipartisan consensus ought to lead to changes in a range of areas that would benefit not just the poor, but these days the poor, the near poor, the just barely out of poverty group, literally the bottom 40 or 50% of Americans, many of whom work full-time, full year, many of whom have two earners in their family, just have not benefited from the kinds of economic changes we've had over the last several decades.
I've got 30 seconds here, really quick. Do you see anything that suggests to you that we should be hopeful about making progress on poverty in the near term?
Well, one's always hopeful. There are a range of ideas that are out there. As you mentioned, the American Enterprise Brookings Working Group showed that a bipartisan group could sit down and agree on a range of proposals relating to family, education, and work that included aspects that were part of the Republican agenda and part of the Democratic agenda. So it's really a matter of finding the will to sit down and agree that government can make things better instead of just blaming government for problems.
Sheldon, thanks for your work. Thanks for your insights. Good to have you on the program. All the best to you, sir.
Thank you.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Mia Birdsong is the co-director of an organization called Family Story, which aims to challenge society's definition of what a traditional or good family is. Mia is a longtime advocate for the poor. She was previously the vice president of the Family Independence Initiative, a project that highlighted the steps low-income families often took to improve their lives. And in 2015, she challenged popular perceptions of the poor in her TED Talk called The Story We Tell About Poverty Isn't True.
Tell me about this TED Talk and what you were trying to get across, and obviously it worked, given that's been viewed, you know, 1.5 million times and counting,
so.
As I said.
Yeah, I mean, I think the evidence that it works is we start to change our policies, right?
Sure.
So I think we have an approach in this country that assumes that the reason that people are poor is because there's something wrong with them,
mm-hmm.
That they've made bad choices or they are somehow broken. And what I always say is poor people are broke, but yeah. They're not broken. The difference between poor people and people who are well off is money. It's not initiative, it's not talent, it's not a desire to have well-being in your life. It's really that we have an economic system that is structured in a way that doesn't allow people to move forward.
Mm-hmm. How then does the definition of family mm-hmm. and of poverty need to change? And I got a follow-up to that.
Yes. Yeah. So we have a way of thinking about family in the U.S. that really, where nuclear families are the gold standard. Mm-hmm. And by nuclear family, I mean a man and a woman married, raising their biological children in an isolated house, mm-hmm. right? That family structure we think of as a tradition, right? But it's not.
Yeah.
That's not what families look like hundreds of years ago, and it's not really what our families look like now. And when you build systems and policies and structures for a family that looks like that, you really leave everybody else out.
Mm-hmm. Our definition of poverty, you talked about this a moment ago, I want to go a little further.
Mm-hmm.
How do we change in the minds of everyday Americans the definition of poverty?
Well, you mean like the technical definition of poverty?
I think when people think poverty, they think a picture. If you ask
yes,
them to pick,
right. They think
you see my point?
Of, yes. So
okay.
So part of it is that we equate, so the definition of poverty is very raced,
sure.
It's very gendered,
there
and
you go.
It is about family structure. So the kind of epitome, I think, for most Americans of what a poor family looks like is a poor single black mother. And there is not sympathy for that family structure because, again, when people think of the hardships that a poor single black woman is facing, they think that it's because of bad choices and some kind of personal failing. When we think of poverty, we actually need to expand from the idea of somebody in crisis to what is actually happening in America. And I know you saw this when you traveled across mm-hmm. the country. We have half of the country living on under, you know, $55,000 a year. The middle class is not actually middle class. People who think they're middle class are not middle class. So when we think about what the people who are struggling in America, it's actually a much larger group of people.
Have you been in any way heartened by anything you've heard or seen up till now on the campaign trail for the White House? That's a long
that's
a pregnant pause, yeah.
You know,
Bernie Sanders, yes.
Yeah. I think that I feel like Bernie Sanders spoke to a segment of the American population that has not been spoken to in a long time.
Right.
But honestly, what mostly moves me and inspires me is families that I have, you know, talked to and worked with over the last 15 years mm-hmm. at this point. Whether they are, you know, no income, single black mothers in Jackson, Mississippi, or they are struggling two-parent families in Oakland, California, I see a lot of the same things. And those folks have figured out, because the systems don't work for them, they're constantly navigating around structures that were not made for them. What I see is people working together, leveraging their social capital in order to get by. Because Black families are framed as broken in America, we don't actually see that Black families have been trailblazing in the family space for hundreds of years. So we have slavery, Jim Crow, forced migration, and the prison system, which are all structures that have intentionally or not tried to keep us from staying connected to our loved ones. And the way in which Black folks make family is very expansive, and it's not bound by blood or law. So, you know, I'm sure that you have aunties who are not the sisters of either of your parents. Everybody I know, from most of the Black folks that I know, have these broad definitions of family. So they have fictive kin, right? So we have people in our families, and that allows us to get by. That's the reason that we survive so long in this country, because we depend on our communities, and that space between community and family is very fluid for us.
Is it just these structures that are holding families back, or are we missing something in the conversation about what's holding American families back?
I think that we assume that in order to have access to well-being and a good life in this country, that you have to deserve it. So we talk about the working poor a lot, right? Because that frames poor people as hardworking, and that for the American psyche means that, like, they're doing something that they're supposed to be doing. And I think, and this has actually evolved since I did my TED Talk last year, I really think that we actually need to assume that every family in America deserves to live a life of dignity, and that they don't have to earn that. That just by existing, they should have access to the things that give us all well-being. And I think if we had that as our like bottom rung in terms of like what we want for people, I think we'd be asking very different questions about how we move people forward.
Politically, though, I hear you and I totally agree. But politically, what does that look like?
That's a good question. I am not a policy person, so I don't know.
Policy-wise, what does it look like?
I mean, it could look like universal basic income. It could look like reparations. I think it could look like a lot of things. And I think that, you know, I think that there are a lot of folks who they hear that and they're like, that's you know, that's crazy and impossible, and like, what, you know, people wouldn't go for that. But I also think that we're at a time when we really need to start being more imaginative and dream bigger. Like, think about, like, what do we actually want for each other? You know, I see kind of the divisiveness that has been revealed from Trump's candidacy. And while I have my opinions about him as a person, when I look at the folks who are supporting him, a lot of what I see is fear. And I can relate to that. I can relate to the feeling that the things that you want for your family are being taken away from you. Now, I disagree with who they think is doing but I think that sense that, like, we all actually need to be in this together, and we actually need to be thinking about a country that cares for each other as a solution to poverty and as a solution to a lot of things. And I think if we had that mindset, we would ask very different questions about what policy needs to look like.
I want to come back to that in a second. But since you mentioned Trump, over the last couple of weeks, we were on hiatus around here. But certainly I was following the news while I was on vacation. Trump, over the last couple of weeks, has framed the Black family the way he apparently thinks Black America operates. And he's kind of framed it as a downtrodden people, an unemployed people, a desperate people. What do you make of the way that in the campaign, at least up until now, he has framed his appeal to these Black poor families that you work with?
You know, I can see that would be attractive to folks, because I think one of the things you experience as a Black person is often the struggles we do face being invisible. But what I actually see is people who are incredibly creative, who are deeply innovative, who are magical and deeply caring of ourselves as communities. So I don't think of us as downtrodden. We have to deal with a lot of stuff that we shouldn't have to deal with, of course. And we are disproportionately represented among the prison population, among people in poverty, among people going to crappy schools, all of those things. But that's not about us. Yeah. That's really about America and how America functions. So I don't see, I'm clear that black folks in America are not gonna be kind of taken in by message like that about themselves, but also from somebody whose track record clearly indicates that he doesn't really care about us.
Let me get back to this point you raised earlier. I would frame it this way, that there is in this country any number of different kinds of poverty. One of them, to my mind, is a poverty of imagination. That's what you kind of intimated a moment ago. There's a poverty of imagination. I wonder what it's going to take for us to be more creative, more innovative about the way we think and address the issue of poverty and income inequality and economic immobility. And I ask that because I could point to 10 other industries where we are thinking as creatively and as innovatively as any people on the planet.
Yep.
But for some reason on this issue, we seem stuck or mired.
Antiquated.
Yeah.
You know, I am of the mind that unless the people who we are looking to support and whose lives we want to improve are actually at the table and have some kind of power in terms of decision making, that we're not actually going to get the solutions that we need.
If they were at the table, what would they be saying to the policymakers? What do you hear from
them? I think, so I hear, you know, right now we don't give poor people money. We have programs and we have services and there's a lot of hoop jumping when it comes to accessing like basic things like healthcare and childcare and education. If we just handed out cash and stopped, you know, paying lots of folks to navigate and mitigate kind of how people access services and programs, I think we'd be a lot better off.
And if I said to you that the powers that be, including many American taxpayers, don't trust poor people.
That's absolutely
with
true.
Cash.
And this is our problem.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we think of, again, we think that poor people are poor because they've made bad decisions, right, as opposed to recognizing that we have a system that doesn't actually work for folks. And I think that part of it is about the middle class really opening its eyes and understanding that their version of middle class is not their parents' and their grandparents' version of middle class. Mm-hmm. There was a brief period where our economy allowed a middle class family to survive on one income. Mm-hmm. That was like, you know, 40 years of our history, and that didn't happen before that, and it hasn't happened since then. And I think we really need to be rethinking, like, what does the good life look like? You know, this is the first generation of folks who is going to be worse off economically than their parents. Mm-hmm. And what I think we're seeing is that folks are really redefining what it means to be better off. And I think as we begin to redefine those things, and I think young people are really pushing for that to happen, we're going to see more folks at the table who resemble, you know, low-income folks.
Thank you for your work, Mia.
Thank you.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. In 2015, L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti signed a measure to increase the minimum wage to $15 per hour by 2020. This move made Los Angeles the largest city in the U.S. to mandate higher pay for minimum wage workers. And earlier this year, the Obama administration announced that an underserved area of South L.A. would be designated a promise zone. This designation allows areas in need to receive special opportunities for federal funding for issues relating to poverty. Mayor Garcetti joins us now to talk about the best ways to increase prosperity for all.
Good to have you on this program.
Thank you. Great to be back.
Your dad was here some months ago.
Yeah, I heard.
His first interview after all that OJ stuff, and he was DA.
Another Tavis Smile exclusive.
Well, yeah, your dad's a great guy. It was good to have him on.
I appreciate it.
Good to have you back on as well.
Yeah, good to be here.
Let me start with this issue of homelessness.
Yes.
There is so much going on in downtown L.A.,
yep.
DTLA.
Yep.
When I go down there now, having worked for Tom Bradley, as you
course,
know,
yeah.
I was just a kid years ago.
Started City Hall.
Yeah, but it was such a LA downtown was so sleepy, and now there's so much energy in downtown. Everybody's coming there; they're building like crazy, and yet this homelessness population is still present.
Yep.
What do we do about homelessness?
Well, you know, I've always said you can't average out prosperity. It's great, we've cut unemployment in half. You have more jobs now than before the unrest in 1992 for the first time in 20-something years. But we've got more people on the streets than we've ever had. And that's happening up and down the West Coast. I think there's cheap drugs on the street. There's a lot of well-intentioned criminal justice reforms, but no safety net yet built in to receive folks. And I think you have to have a connection of all of the pieces. When people say that homelessness is about housing, they're right. When they say it's about wages, they're right. When they say it's about the foster care system, they're right. Veterans, mental health, substance abuse, it's all of those things. You know, I met a woman named Natalia in Hollywood a few months ago. I just visited her this past week in her new apartment. We got her off the street. She came from Atlanta. She suffers from some severe mental health issues. She was doing drugs to treat that on the street. You know, every person has a different formula to get them off the streets. But if you just throw money at a problem or do services on the street with no housing or housing with no services, you'll never get people permanently off the street. We're trying to do both together. And we showed some great success with our veterans population. Now I want to take it to the non-veteran population too.
What did you do with veterans?
With veterans, we brought everybody to the table. We said, feds, you got to step up. We got vouchers from the VA and from HUD. We brought together the county, which offers the services for mental health and physical health, together with the city that builds the housing. We had 2,300 vets that were homeless when I started this. We've now housed over 6,000. And you scratch your head and say, how those numbers connect. More than four or five a day of new vets were falling out on the street. We'll probably declare victory sometime next year, the most in the country housed. But it was only when we brought everybody together and said, we've got to case manage each of these people. We only had eight people doing outreach in a county of 10 million people. That's not enough. So it's increasing those resources and then bringing people together.
You mentioned the county a couple of times already in our conversation. For those who live and work in L.A. or know L.A., you have the city, of course, and the county. It's hard to do anything without both of them being at some point in concert. So this homelessness issue is not just a city problem, it's a county problem. How do you get government agencies, government offices to work together, government entities to pool their resources to address the issue? You can't just be a city solution.
You cannot. And I think personalities matter. Mark Ridley Thomas, who's a county supervisor here, and I talk probably last conversation before our spouses at night, first in the morning. You know, it's, you have to say, look, no more protecting the turf. If we care about the person, like downtown, we have something called C3. That's county, city, and community together. You know, a cop walking and doing social work isn't going to work. A social worker without protection isn't going to work. If you get a referral, say you're a firefighter who picks somebody up having a drug overdose, if you don't get that person to a program that the county runs, it's not going to succeed. You'll be out there next week getting that same person off the street. So we put people around the table every week. We learn the names of people, and we've entered them into a single database. So if it's Tavis or Eric, we know what his problems are. We know what his history is. And the next time we touch him, we're not going to go back to the beginning and say, where are you from? What's your story? What are your challenges? And that really humanizes the issue.
Since you mentioned Natalia earlier in this conversation from Atlanta, as I recall, I've never asked this question, but I'm curious about it now, and I work for the mayor, and it didn't occur to me then. How much of LA's homelessness issue has to do with people coming here from other places? Because, as you said, it's California, it's the sunshine. They fall on fall on hard times, or fall on their luck, or mental issue, whatever it might be. But how much of our homeless issue has to do with other people coming here from other places and increasing that number?
Well, it's interesting. Natalia came out here because she wanted to be a singer, she wanted to be a rapper, she wanted to make it in Hollywood.
So did I, and I didn't make it either.
You made it, but maybe not as that. As Kobe Bryant told me during Kobe Day, because he heard me rap, he's like, I'm glad we both have day jobs. But I think, you know, a smaller percentage of the population that's homeless is from out of town than the average person in Los Angeles. So in other words, most of it, more of it is homegrown. Even though people come here, nobody comes here to be homeless. They come here to find themselves, to get away from something, to get a job, and then they become homeless. But it's actually a smaller percentage than the population at large. 62% of the city are either immigrants or children of immigrants, and that doesn't count migrants inside the United States. So I think it's one of the common misconceptions that our sun and our social services attracts people. I think that attracts people to be here, but not to be homeless here. They wind up becoming homeless once they get here.
So you can't talk about homelessness without talking about housing.
That's right.
We're talking this week, and I talked on this tour that I took, it's probably 2 or 5 years ago, about the issue of housing in our country and this growing notion, which I subscribe to, that housing is a right, that housing is a human right. That's what I believe. Talk to me about the connection, the link between housing or lack thereof and homelessness in this city.
Well, we're facing a housing crisis unlike anything we've ever seen. We don't have the highest rents in the country, but we do have the biggest gap in this county between rents and average wages. Mm-hmm. So part of what we've tried to do is say, we need to build more housing. Let's get past that moment where we say, I don't want that to be built in my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I don't want that to build here. We need 100,000 units of housing to begin to release the demand that's out there. Second, we got to start raising the floor. That's mm-hmm. what raising the minimum wage was about. Mm-hmm. Too many people are working two or three minimum wage jobs and can't make the rent. If you want to hear a great statistic or a sad statistic, but it's a great statistic to highlight how bad things mm-hmm. are, about 60% of our population is now what's called rent burdened. They're paying 30% or more of their income just to meet the rent.
60%.
Uh-huh. And, wow. and about 30% is paying 60% or more. So you have over a quarter of this city paying over half of their income just to make the rent. That's before they can decide what they're gonna eat, yeah. what shoes they're gonna buy their kids. So when you look at homelessness, it ties into the housing and larger poverty issue. You've gotta raise that floor, you've gotta widen the room, because it's not just the $15 an hour job. You've gotta yeah. train formerly homeless people to get a $50 an hour job. And then you've gotta blow the roof off too and make sure that wealth is going into communities and populations that traditionally have not been able to build that wealth.
What does it say about our city? And I didn't like what you said, and I know other examples of cities yeah. who are far worse off than we are.
Sure.
But what does it say about a city that knows it needs housing, knows the stats you just laid out, but there are still segments of this city who say, not near me?
Well, I get it. When people are stuck in traffic, they say, oh, if you build more housing, it's going to make it worse.
Yeah.
I always point out, if people have housing closer to their jobs, the traffic actually gets better.
Yeah.
You can either plan for it or not. And I think that that philosophy is slowly kind of dying out. You see more and more people saying, build public transportation, put housing, but not just luxury housing. One of the things I'm pushing here for that housing is a human right. If we're building luxury housing, those developers should pay in a fee, a mm-hmm. linkage fee, to be able to put into a fund to build affordable housing that we can subsidize. Why the state doesn't allow us to expand rent stabilization, rent control, to any buildings built after 1978, I think that's wrong too. I mean, so if you win the lottery and you're in one of those units, you're okay. It only goes up 2 or 3% a year. Mm-hmm. But if you're out there on the marketplace, you can't find anything.
What's the state's reason for not adjusting that?
Everybody says, oh, the real estate lobby will never let you.
Yeah.
You know, they just, even though we have almost 2/3 Democrats at the state legislature, people say don't ever touch that. San Francisco tried to get just a carve out for San Francisco, saying we won't change any other
yeah.
city, and it couldn't get a 2/3 vote in the assembly.
Yeah. So let me ask your advice to other cities about how they pull off what you were able to do here
yeah.
in a city the size of L.A., a minimum wage increase
yep.
that kicks in by 2020.
Yeah, the full amount.
Full
yeah,
amount.
We started this year.
Yeah, full amount by 2020. But what do you say to other cities about the journey
yeah.
and the reward of being able to take this issue on?
Well, I'll say be brave.
Yeah.
Cities are not places that are just for the rich and then the poor who support them.
Mm-hmm.
The middle class sustains a city, makes them interesting. It makes it a place people still want to come. And a majority of Republicans and Democrats support the minimum wage going up. A majority of Democrats and Republicans support affordable housing. A majority of Republicans and Democrats want public transportation that works. But don't expect Washington to save the day. There's no cavalry coming in right now. They will assist if you come with a hat half filled, like we have done mm-hmm. here from LA. But don't come with an empty hat anymore.
You mentioned transportation. How much does that factor into this? You can't talk about poverty again without talking about transportation.
Yeah.
We have a big metro rail project underway here that will make the city more accessible for people who
yeah.
can ride the train. But how do you solve the transportation issue?
You need to build out a network that works. Like
yeah.
here in Los Angeles, a quarter of people now don't have a car.
Yeah.
You know, but nobody thinks that in the car capital of America that's even
yeah.
possible. We
yeah.
have a third biggest system. But you got to build it out so it's not just if you're lucky that where you happen to work
mm-hmm.
and where you happen to live, there's a connection. It's got to go everywhere. So we're looking this fall at $120 billion investment we're putting before the voters to do the next 40 years of public transportation investment. And when you assemble those lines, they're really economic development lines
mm-hmm.
that happen to have transportation running through them. And if you do them right, you assemble that land, turn it into affordable housing, turn it into locally owned businesses. So, you know, the Crenshaw line, for instance, close
mm-hmm.
to where you are,
yeah.
there's not going to be a displacement of people or of businesses, because black-owned businesses on Crenshaw are very important for
mm-hmm.
all of us to have, so we have assistance to keep those businesses going. But look at public transportation as economic development, as a poverty solver, and not least of which is because the jobs making these lines are great middle-class jobs for folks who don't have a college education.
Finally, I know you're with Hillary and not the
yep,
other guy,
yep.
But what have you heard, not heard, want to hear about the issue of poverty and income inequality and economic immobility between mm-hmm. now and Election Day from either or both of these candidates?
I've heard the cry from both of them,
mm-hmm.
things aren't working, But really, I haven't heard a lot of solutions from one guy. Mm-hmm. I love the solution in terms of infrastructure investments, the biggest since Eisenhower that Hillary Clinton wants to mm-hmm. do, $275 billion that will leverage cities like our investments. But I think that oftentimes we're hearing a lot about how tough it is for the middle class that feels like they're going down, but the very poor has been hardly a voice.
Mm-hmm. Very astute, Mayor Garcetti, and that's why you're the mayor.
Thank
Good
you.
To see you, sir.
Good to see you, too.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel N.C. Abwadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.